like to thank everybody for being here this afternoon. It's getting towards the end of this thing, and it's good to see such a good crowd. It's also kind of an honor for me, being new to wireworms, to be able to speak in the same program with a bunch of wireworm experts. So we're going to shift gears now. We've talked a lot about wireworms and Irish potatoes. We're going to talk about wireworms some in sweet potatoes now, and talk about a novel approach to wireworm management in sweet potatoes. A little bit of background information about sweet potatoes that some of you are probably well aware of, some of you may not know. Sweet potatoes are worth about $370 million a year to farmers in the United States, and 80% of that production occurs in the southern part of the U.S. Most of it is in Louisiana, Mississippi, and North Carolina. Those of you who are familiar with the propagation of Irish potatoes know that you plant seed pieces. We don't plant seed pieces with sweet potatoes. We plant shoots, or slips is what we call them in the industry. They're transplanted in the spring. Normally in North Carolina that happens in beginning and the end of May, and then going through the first week of July. We expect, depending on the variety that we're growing in North Carolina, we expect the crop to be in the field somewhere between 100 and probably 120 days. And that's a long time for a crop that you're harvesting the roots of to be in the soil and be exposed to potential soil pests. And that's really the reason why I'm here talking to you today. The research that I'm going to talk about was done as a part of the Southern Sweet Potato IPM project, and that was a RAMP grant funded project by USDA. It was a multidisciplinary project. We had faculty members from entomology and plant pathology and hort science, from Auburn, LSU, Mississippi State, and NC State, all working together to improve pest management in sweet potatoes. But from the entomology perspective, we really had three goals for this project, or three main objectives. And the first one was to characterize and understand the insect problems that we were seeing in sweet potatoes in the southern U.S. Prior to the initiation of this project, we were really working under the assumption that the insect problems that we were seeing in the southern U.S. were the same from state to state. And not surprisingly, we found that that's not really the case, but that was one of our first objectives. Second objective seems to go without saying, we wanted to improve management of root feeding insects. And then last but not least, reduce the use of high-risk FUPA targeted insecticides. And it's probably worth mentioning here, prior to the beginning of this project, the standard insect management, soil insect management program for growers in the southern U.S. pretty much revolved around a pre-plant broadcast incorporated application of typically chlorpyrifos or Lorsban, and then that would be followed by some number of foliar insecticide applications post-plant. So it might be some growers would apply zero, but some growers would make as many as 12 applications over the course of the season, which is basically once a week. And those applications were targeting the adults of the insects that are feeding on the roots as larvae. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the study methods, but I would like for you to get a little bit of an idea of the scope of the project. Just in North Carolina, we were working with 25 different commercial growers to cooperate with us on this project. Over the course of the project from 04 to 07, we had commercial field study sites in over 100 commercial sweet potato fields. The setup in these fields is pretty simple. The growers agreed to let us have a 16-row wide by 300-foot-long block of potatoes that they would not apply any insecticide to. So otherwise they were managed the same as the rest of their crop. So they got the same herbicide, same fertilizer, but no insecticide. We set up plots within that block, and then we set up plots in an adjacent block where the growers applied whatever their standard insect management practice was. And then we could compare the untreated potatoes versus the potatoes that came from the grower's own practices. We would dig those roots at harvest time. We'd wash them. We'd take them back to the lab, wash them, and rate them for damage. And the three primary types of insect damage that we were seeing was, one, the wireworm damage that you see here that we've seen is very similar to what you see in Irish potatoes. Sweet potato flea beetle damage, it's characterized by these very shallow, narrow tunnels on the root surface. And then white grub damage, which is broad, shallow gouges on the root surface. This table just gives you an idea of what the severity of the damage is from each one of those kinds of insects. This comes from the grower's treated portion of the field. So this is what we're getting on average in a season when the growers are treating for these soil insects. So you can see wireworms, they're not only the highest level of damage is in terms of all the insects, but wireworm damage is also, in terms of marketability, is a big deal for growers. Just a couple of wireworm holes will render a root unmarketable for fresh market. What that data that I just showed you did for us is it really allowed us to focus our attention. So we've got a lot of potential insects to work on. We see that wireworms are number one, so we want to focus more on what's going on with wireworms. So after we harvested potatoes, we put in all that damaged root data, and we go back and look at it. One of the things we wanted to do was look at cultural practices, environmental conditions, what things are going on in the field that contribute to wireworm damage. And the thing that really struck us right off the bat in 2004, after the first year doing this work, is that when we looked at the number of foliar insecticide applications that these guys were making, there's no significant difference in the amount of wireworm damage coming in these fields when you have guys who didn't apply any foliar insecticide compared to guys who were applying 2 to 3 applications, 4 to 5 applications. And most everybody's putting out a pre-plant, but there were a few growers who didn't put out the foliar applications. So that raises a red flag right there, saying, okay, we're not getting any control. Is that a year effect, or is that something that's consistent from year to year? As it turns out, we saw this same exact result in every year of our study. The foliar insecticides that the growers were using were not controlling the soil insects and wireworms specifically. The next question we asked is, if our foliar insecticides aren't working, well, what in the world is the pre-plant working? So in 2005, we went to the growers and said, can we have another block of sweet potatoes in your field? And they were gracious enough to allow us to have another 16-row block where all they did was apply their chlorpyrifos pre-plant and not apply any foliar insecticides. And so we had, in 2005, we had 16 rows of untreated sweet potatoes. We had 16 rows of sweet potatoes that only got chlorpyrifos pre-plant. And then we had 16 rows where the growers went in with their pre-plant insecticide plus whatever foliar sprays that they would have made as a part of their regular regime. And what you can see is we've got significant reductions in these two treatments versus the untreated control. But again, there's no statistical difference between Lorsban alone or Lorsban plus the foliar sprays, which is telling us that all the benefit we were getting from our insect management practices was coming straight from the pre-plant insecticide. So what now, right? Well, the question that we asked then is one that's been emphasized here by a number of speakers, and that is, wireworms are going to react differently to different species of wireworms are going to react differently to different control practices, and we needed to know what species of wireworms we were dealing with so we would know if there's anything in the world that we could do to try to control them. So as you've heard, a lot of folks use soil baits to sample wireworms, and that's what we did. Very quickly, our sampling procedures, we used steam crimped oats. We went to the field, we would soak these oats overnight in water, go to the field, we would take a bulb planter like you see here, put a hole right in the center of the sweet potato bed, fill it up within an inch of the soil surface with the oats, cover it up, put a flag in it. We'd come back in 2 weeks with a golf cup cutter, which would remove not only the oats right here in the center, but also about an inch or so of soil all the way around. And that's typically where we would find the wireworms, is in that area of soil around the bait. Very rarely were they actually within the oats themselves. So we would take those individually, put them into Ziploc bags, load them up in the car or the truck, and bring them back to Raleigh. And that's when the real work began, because each one of these samples had to be hand processed on a cafeteria tray. And we were doing this. This is what you look like when you get done. And from 2004 to 2007, we processed over 40,000 pounds of soil on cafeteria trays by hand like this. And I will say that I'm not the one who did most of it. We had other folks helping us out on this one, thank God. But it is extremely labor intensive. You would never write a grant proposal and say, I'm going to process 40,000 pounds of soil, because you wouldn't believe you could do it, but it was done. The wireworms were put into alcohol. We put them under the scope, identified them to species. I very much would like for Paul to take a look at some of these now. And we also measured their head capsule width. Interesting result here. What we found is that our species complex in sweet potatoes is dominated by this species right here, Conodaris vespertinus. 80% of the wireworms that we recovered were vespertinus, which is the tobacco wireworm. We had at least 8 different species that we recovered. from my standpoint, the fact that most of the wireworms were one species was a real positive, because what it did is we had narrowed our research from all the soil pests to wireworms, and now we're able to narrow our focus from wireworms to the tobacco wireworm. So then we would want to look at the aspects of the biology of this insect that would lead us to hopefully a control practice that would work. To help us tease out some of the biology of this insect, we went back to our soil sampling data, because from that we were able to get information about the relative temporal abundance of the larvae, and also developmental data through the head capsule measurements. And we also had yellow sticky traps in all of these commercial grower fields, so we were able to look at that and again see the relative temporal abundance of the adults in these fields. This first graph is showing you the head capsule width of the tobacco wireworm larvae that we collected in 2005 and 2006 across the growing season. And what this really shows to us is that we're dealing with a univoltine insect. So if you look here in the spring, we're collecting fairly large insects, and then about July, around July 19th, middle of July, the size of those larvae, the average size of those larvae, goes down considerably. And what we've got here is overwintered generation. The adults emerge, they lay eggs, we start picking up the current season larvae here. We don't really get neonates in our samples. We're not able to reliably collect those. We'll find one every once in a while, but they're just too small for the way we're sampling them. And then you see that the numbers go up as you get towards the fall. We developed this little cartoon to show the life cycle of the tobacco wireworm. Again, you know that we've got, from November to April, we've got that previous generation in the field overwintering. We start to get pupation. Adults are laying eggs by June. Our peak egg laying is going on in July. By then, we also have new generation of larvae that are down here in the roots. And then we've got, for the remainder of the season, we've got big larvae down there feeding on our roots. This figure is just to demonstrate the temporal abundance of the different life stages. So if we look here, these would be the overwintering larvae, and these data came from our sampling in the untreated block. So the fact that this line is going down has nothing to do with control, and has everything to do with the fact that the larvae are pupating and emerging as adults. And you see what you would expect, a corresponding increase in the number of adults on our sticky traps. You see that we have a peak here in early July of adult numbers on our sticky traps. Now the adults are out there, they're not doing the hokey pokey, they're laying eggs, and we've got eggs being laid probably sometime, you know, late June through the 1st of August, but we expect that the majority of these eggs are being laid right here in the first week or so of July. And then about 10 days after the eggs are first laid, we expect the larvae to hatch based on the literature. Again, as I mentioned, we don't really collect neonates. But so the question we ask then is, looking at these data, is there something we can do here to target these insects that's beyond applying the pre-plant insecticide? We know that the pre-plant insecticide is targeting the overwintering larvae, and they're actually doing a pretty good job. I'm not going to show the data, but we don't get a lot of larvae in the plots where the growers have applied their pre-plant. So that's already being done. For years, growers have been targeting these adults with foliar sprays. It doesn't work, so that's not going to work. So the question then becomes, is there something that we can do that might disrupt these eggs, or that would prevent these larvae, these new generation larvae, from making it down to the sweet potato roots? This is a little cartoon we made up for a grower meeting, but it demonstrates what's going on. If you've got an untreated bed, this is after your, you know, by the time the roots are beginning to swell, your pre-plant insecticide is gone, so effectively you've got an untreated bed. The adult comes in and lays their eggs, and they're laid fairly shallow in sweet potatoes, from what we can tell based on the literature. The eggs hatch and the larvae move to the roots. Once they're in those roots, there's nothing labeled in sweet potato that we can apply to get there. If they're there, they're home free, and you're up the creek. So what we need to do is try to see if there's something we can do to prevent the larvae from making it to those roots. And our idea was to come up with a practice, we call it a soil barrier treatment. You can think about this in the same way as you'd think about a termite treatment on your house. It creates an insecticide barrier in the soil here. The eggs would be laid into this barrier, the neonate larvae would hatch into this insecticide treated soil and would never be able to make it to the roots. Growers, if y'all work with farmers and they're accustomed to making directed applications, it's really not a big deal for them to do something like this. They all have spray rigs that they can can direct an application where it needs to be. This is a photograph of the application being made in the field. You can see here the spray nozzle on the toolbar. It's over the row. We prefer that it not be. We prefer two nozzles directed towards the row, but this guy has his setup was already done this way. And then he's got rolling cultivators behind, immediately behind the toolbar. So not only is he incorporating that soil, but those cultivators are set so that it pulls soil up towards the base of the plant. So you want to get that barrier as complete as you can from the top of the plant all the way down into the bottom of the furrow. So this is just we'll show this again. Those eggs are laid there, and then whammo, theoretically you're going to kill them. This is another just a before and after photo, and you can really tell here these vines had started to run. After the application was made, it's pushed that soil up against those plants. So we've got treated soil as close to the base of that plant as we can get, and that's really the objective, is not to leave any untreated soil out there. To get to the data, in theory, that's all really good. So did it work in practice? And what we found was this is probably the cleanest data I've ever gotten in an experiment that I've ever done. So I'm really proud of this. I show it every chance I get. This was an on-farm trial, believe it or not. That makes it even more amazing. And it wasn't just one farm. This was over four different farms managed by different growers, although I did apply the treatments. So we had an untreated control. We had bifenthrin, which is what we used for our soil barrier treatment, alone. We had chlorpyrifos as a pre-plant treatment alone. And then we had chlorpyrifos pre-plant plus the soil barrier treatment of bifenthrin. And if you look at this, you see we had about 40% or a little better percent damage in the untreated. That damage was reduced almost by half in each instance where you used the PPI alone or the soil barrier treatment alone. But when you combine those two treatments, you reduce that damage down to about 10%, which is getting into the realm of being reasonable when you're talking about dealing with an untreated level of over 40%. We also conducted the similar trials on experiment stations on small plots. This was even more remarkable because of the sheer level of wireworm damage that we were getting in our untreated. Over 80% of these roots were damaged by wireworm. Again, if you only had the chlorpyrifos pre-plant, you're reducing that significantly to about 30% damage. But when you add that bifenthrin as a soil barrier treatment, you're knocking that down to around 15%. And again, 15%, growers will tell you, is unacceptable. But by God, if you got 80% in the untreated, that's pretty darn good in my mind. So by 2006, we had developed the idea. We had talked about it at grower meetings. And so in 2006, we actually had commercial growers who were trying it based on very preliminary data because they were desperate, basically. So at the end of the season, we looked at the growers. These are commercial fields. Growers who had used a pre-plant plus a soil barrier treatment, we grouped all those fields together in our study. The fields in our study where there's a pre-plant but no soil barrier treatment, we grouped all those fields together. And what we saw was that there was a 57% reduction in wireworm damage in the treated portion of the field versus our untreated block where the soil barrier treatment was applied, compared to only a 28% reduction in damage where there were no soil barrier treatments. And granted, this averages over any other management approach that they might have had. They were still applying foliar sprays, some of them, given that they didn't work. We just kind of ignored those anyway. But these data, again, just corroborate what we had found earlier in our replicated test. To summarize very quickly, if you'll remember, our objectives were to find out what the pests really were. We were able to do that. In North Carolina, tobacco wireworm is our most important sweet potato pest. Our second major objective was to improve management. So what we were able to do is, one, eliminate a practice that didn't work. Growers were doing this for years. They've been making foliar sprays. It's not effective. We were able to show that it wasn't effective, and then provide them with an effective alternative, and that was the pre-plant plus soil barrier treatment. So we were able to significantly improve the grower's ability to control wireworms. And then finally, because they had an alternative that worked, we were able to significantly reduce the amount of FQPA-targeted insecticides that were applied in sweet potato in North Carolina. And those materials ranged from, we had a lot of OPs going out into sulfan. We had a lot of that. We had a lot of 7 being applied, basically all for nothing. And so we were able to cut that out. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge a lot of folks. I especially want to mention George Kennedy. This work was primarily done as I was a postdoc in his lab. So the work was done in conjunction with him and then a lot of other folks who helped out. We had, I once told someone we had a small army of folks to do those wireworm samples, the soil samples, but what we really had was a highly motivated platoon. It was not really an army. It was a small group of people who did an awful lot of work, and I think it was pretty good work. So anyway, I don't know if we have time for a question, but one question if anybody's got one. Yes, sir. Well, that's the good question, though. The question was, how do you time the application of the soil barrier treatment? And to begin with, our idea was that needed to be there before the bulk of those eggs hatched, because you want the soil barrier treatment there before the larvae move down into the to the roots. The issue there is timing that from year to year. Last year, I had a lot of tests out to look at timing, making that application at different times during the season. Our data were really messy. I'm not sure what that means. We're basically telling growers that you want that application out there by the 1st of July, because that seems to cover it. But we have gotten into trouble. If we wait a week, we've gotten into trouble. So get it out by the 1st of July. Yes, sir. Well, the first point, well, the question is there any mechanical mortality caused by the cultivation? And the cultivation application, the growers are already cultivating their sweet potatoes, so we're adding a practice onto that. But in our trials, we cultivated without spraying the untreated portion of the field, and it's definitely not attributed to mortality in cultivation, because we did control for that.